It's Monday, August 13, 2012. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Standing in front of the USS Wisconsin on Saturday, Mitt Romney announced his running mate for the 2012 presidential race. It is none other than Paul Davis Ryan, a seven-term congressman from Wisconsin who is also chairman of the House Budget Committee. This is one of those announcements that makes history simply because of the importance of the position to which he will be nominated by the Republican Party. We're talking about the Vice President of the United States. But in this case, as in many recent elections, if not most, we're looking at the fact that the choice of a vice presidential candidate becomes a major marker for the entire campaign. A lot of expectation was poured into this, if for no other reason than there is mystery about the vice presidential candidate on only one side of the political ledger this year. After all, President Obama made very clear that the incumbent vice president, former Senator Joseph Biden, now vice president, will be running again on the Democratic ticket. But there's a great deal of mystery about the direction that Mitt Romney would turn. After all, there are many qualified candidates. And as many of them were known to have been vetted and cleared in recent weeks, the speculation was that the choice would indicate the kind of campaign that Mr. Romney intends to pursue toward the November election. And the choice of Paul Ryan is perhaps the most dramatic of the choices that were available to him. Paul Ryan is indeed not only the chairman of the House Budget Committee, but he is a young Republican intellectual who has guaranteed now that there will be a stark choice in terms of economic, tax, and budget policies between the Republican and the Democratic campaigns. There is a lot to be looked at here just in terms of what this means for the Republican choice and what it means for Americans in November. But one thing we know right now is that this means very clearly that Mitt Romney and the Republican Party intend to make economic issues front and center in the campaign. That might not appear to be total news, but it is news in a very important way that this choice certainly clarifies. In the past several weeks, there have been many who have suspected that Governor Romney is going to run a campaign against President Obama, basically pointing to the inadequacies and failures of the Obama record. What the choice of Paul Ryan makes clear is that the Romney campaign, Mr. Romney himself, has decided to choose a running mate who will instead clarify the issues in terms of alternative Republican plans. One of the things for which Paul Ryan has been known for all of his congressional tenure, and especially over the last 4 to 5 years, is that he is a master of the budget. He himself has become a policy expert on matters of economics, and he not only cut his teeth on these issues, but he has pursued them with an unusual sense of personal crusade. And that's why he has been under the skin of President Obama. There is personal animosity between these two men, and why this guarantees the campaign is going to be more interesting going into November. Those who are making bare political calculations will have many things to consider here. After all, if Mr. Romney had chosen a safe running mate, that is, a safe choice that had no controversy, that would be an indication that he wanted to avoid the issues. This choice says he's leaning into the issues, and time will tell whether the American people are going to respond to that. But it does change the equation in ways that many had not foreseen. For instance, considering the debates, it's going to be very interesting to see how the debate between Vice President Biden and Representative Ryan will shape up, because it's going to be a policy slugfest. And Americans need that. One of the things Americans need in the course of this presidential campaign is to come to a clear understanding of exactly what the economic, budgetary, and tax issues are in order to make an informed decision. And that's one of the things that Mr. Ryan will help about. Congressman Ryan knows how to define those issues. Now, the downside for the Republicans is that many Americans might not like what they hear, which is to say that these Republican policy pronouncements that are going to be coming, especially from the Romney campaign at this point, especially from Congressman Ryan, are going to threaten the received wisdom by which the American political class has governed the economy and the budget and the taxation system over the last two generations. Now, there are many who've been looking for this, who've been champions for this kind of systemic change, but the American electorate is a fickle electorate. Sometimes they appear to want to deal with issues. They usually say they do. But when it comes to the actual process of an election, how they weigh differing issues, whether they're talking about personality or just the general sense of the direction and momentum of the culture, or whether it's social issues or whether it's economic issues, they don't always actually vote on the very bases that they say they're going to vote. In terms of the man, Paul Ryan, James Carroll of the Louisville Courier-Journal makes very clear that he has attributes that might not be those that are first in mind to the media. For instance, he's a conservative Roman Catholic in a year when the Catholic vote could be, as Carroll says, pivotal in a number of battlegrounds, particularly in his native Midwest. Carroll goes on to say he comes from Wisconsin. The state Democrats have won in every election dating to 1988. If the Romney-Ryan ticket were to prevail in the Badger state, that would scramble some of the Electoral College calculations at Obama's headquarters. Furthermore, Mr. Carroll goes on to say, Ryan has the potential to make Romney a better candidate. Anyone who has watched the two-man campaign together has seen the chemistry that exists between them. End quote. That's an indicator of the personality dimension of politics that many people miss. There are some who bring out the best in each other. There are some who bring out almost nothing visible in each other. And there are some that bring out the worst in each other. It is going to be very, very helpful to Romney if indeed Congressman Ryan brings out the best in him, both in terms of his personality and his policies. Another very insightful column in response to the Ryan announcement came in Sunday's edition of the New York Times. Robert Pear wrote, many Republicans come across as dour budget cutters with contempt for Democrats. Mr. Ryan shares the politics of his conservative colleagues, but appears instead as an optimist who relishes the opportunity to debate policy with Democrats. He goes on to say, Mr. Ryan was first elected to Congress in 1998 at the age of 28, the youngest member of that incoming class. He vaulted to the top ranks of the party and became chairman of the Budget Committee because he knew the ropes, studied the issues, and could explain conservative tax-cutting and budget-cutting policies in lucid terms. It never has been enough for him to attack Democrats and their proposals. He has always been eager to propose and defend alternatives, even at significant political risk to himself and his party. Finally, Mr. Pear says, he is hardly a typical committee chairman, a role often played in the House by grizzled old men. An avid hunter, skier, and mountaineer, Mr. Ryan listens to heavy metal and indulges in a grueling fitness regimen. At the House gym, he encourages other members to do the same as he coaches them on the intricacies of the federal budget. End quote. In terms of his personal life, he is married and has three children, and he is a Roman Catholic by conviction. It will be very important for all of us to watch how the worldview issues that have framed Paul Ryan the man work out in terms of his role now as the presumptive vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party. 17 days after the games began, the London Olympiad came to a conclusion yesterday. The closing ceremonies came in evening time in London, but mid-afternoon in the United States. The United States ended with a medal count at the very top of the charts, 104 total medals, 46 gold, 29 silver, 29 bronze. China, that is the People's Republic of China, came in second place with 87 total medals, 38 gold, 27 silver, 22 bronze. Great Britain, that was shamed in recent Olympiads in terms of having so few medals, was determined in this time that they hosted the Games to do much better. And they came in third with 65 total medals, including 29 golds, 17 silvers, and 19 bronze. The Russian Federation, that had been formidable during the Cold War, where the main competition had been between the United States and the Soviet Union, well, the vestigial states of the Soviet Union, now known as the Russian Federation, came in with 82 total medals, 24 gold, 25 silver, 33 bronze. Interestingly, the fifth-ranking nation was the Republic of Korea with 28 total medals. One of the other things that is rather noteworthy in terms of looking at the total rankings is how many nations came up with only one or two medals. At the very bottom of the rankings were nations such as Tajikistan, Morocco, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Hong Kong, Bahrain, Afghanistan. All of those had only one medal, and all of them were bronze. Culture makes a difference, and that becomes very clear, because when you think about those at the top of this list and those at the bottom of this list, one thing is very clear: money does matter, but it doesn't matter ultimately. After all, it's hard to come up with a nation that has per capita wealth higher than that of Saudi Arabia or that of Kuwait. But they're at the very bottom of the list. It turns out that this kind of sporting event just is not a major cultural or national priority. In terms of the recent Olympiad, there are many issues to discuss. The motto of the Olympic Games was faster, higher, stronger. And one of the things to note in all of this is that there is a certain kind of Olympian ambition that's reflected, not very honestly, in these games. After all, even as several world records were broken in various kinds of events, a closer look demonstrates that they weren't broken perhaps in the ways people might have expected. For instance, the Wall Street Journal had a major article on Saturday on the fact that they have used high technology to make such things as the pool itself faster. New fabrics and new technologies in terms of swimwear and other things for other events have also decreased the time. They've lowered the threshold in terms of the actual human achievement. The New York Times had a very fascinating chart indicating that even as there has been radical progress in terms of some events, mostly having to do with things like swimming and running, over the Olympiads of the past century, very little progress has been made in such things as the javelin throw or the shot put. It turns out that the human body has certain limitations that no available technology or training has seemingly been able to overcome. And one of the things that also becomes clear if the motto is going to be faster, higher, and stronger is that the desire to go faster, higher, and to become stronger induces many to cheat, and frankly is now pointing to the age of enhancement as something that will be a perpetual struggle for the Olympiad and for the entire Olympic movement. When you think about the age of enhancement, you realize that there is now no expectation in many of these events and sports that one can actually get to a winning space on the platform just doing it the old-fashioned way. And so there are negotiations and rules and tests and all the rest, and there will be debates about this ongoing. The nature of achievement and the ambiguity of many of these achievements is something that Christians should well understand. We do understand excellence and what it means to excel, but there's a distinction between excellence for the sake of excellence or excellence for the sake of individual ego and what Christians must understand as the ultimate excellence, which is to the glory of God. There have been many throughout the history of the Olympics who have demonstrated that kind of achievement, such as Eric Liddell, the famous British runner who won the gold medal and then became a martyr for the Christian faith. But there have been others, such as Usain Bolt, who very clearly said that the most important thing in the world is Usain Bolt in terms of his own comments. The ambiguity of this kind of achievement leads us to stand back in some honest awe and wonder at how someone could achieve some of these things. But then you also recognize, and Christians must recognize, the ultimate understanding the Bible also gives to such things with the witness of the book of Ecclesiastes. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. At the end of the day, even as the motto is faster, higher, stronger, we can never in human might achieve anything that will liberate us from the human problem by doing anything faster and higher and stronger. This kind of event also puts forth to the public a kind of claim that we understand tacitly, if not overtly, just isn't quite honest. The Olympiad does not lead to world peace. It may indeed lead to a temporary relationship between some of those who are competing against each other and to a spirit of some kind of international bonhomie. But at the end of the day, the nations that were at war and conflict before the recent London Games are so at the conclusion. And as Christians understand the moral ambiguity of the games themselves, we understand the moral ambiguity of the life that now continues with the Olympiad having concluded. There are so many issues that demand our attention this week, and we will get to them in days ahead. In the meantime, news came late last night that Billy Graham has been hospitalized in North Carolina. The Associated Press indicated that the 93-year-old evangelist is being treated at a North Carolina hospital for bronchitis. The joint statement came from Graham's spokesman and from Mission Hospital saying he was admitted overnight for an infection in his lungs. The story goes on to say, by the way, that Mr. Graham is working on yet another book after the last book that was said to be his very last book. This is a man who at age 93 is still writing, still thinking, and even now asking for prayer. The Associated Press reports that he is resting comfortably in stable condition. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.